Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be in this building. The last time I did one of these seminars, I ended up as a special economic advisor to one of the committees, which is probably the most challenging, interesting, enjoyable thing I've done in my whole academic career. The title of this is Making Sense of Britain's Challenges to Economic Citizenship. And this comes out of a strategic research area at the Open University on citizenship and governance. And this notion of citizenship, economic citizenship, in its fullest sense, came about of a joint bid that Graham Brownlow at Queen's and I did together on the impact of economic citizenship and governance in relation to the agri-food sector. And Graham and I are doing a double act at the Sunflower Pub as part of the ESRC Festival of Social Science in 2 weeks' time. And it's my favourite pub, and I hope you can come along. Okay, so that's good. Right, well, I thought, I was recently on holiday in Croatia, and we had a really nice apartment overlooking the old city. And there's this boat, this old boat, or copy of a boat, sailing around the harbour every night. And I found out it was part of the Game of Thrones. and you could argue that the Brexit negotiations so far are a kind of Game of Thrones. And I'm sure someone will write an analogy at some point. The other thing that's become interesting to me in the research I've been doing is the way in which I used to hate law as study, not because of any personal dislike, but I had a friend who was originally from Northern Ireland who was blind, and he was training to be a barrister, and I recorded some of the books for him. And I thought, this takes such an effort, learning all this stuff and absorbing it, then you can interpret it. But I think what has come out of Brexit is the connections between the economic, the political, and the constitutional. And I was given a paper yesterday by on British Academy, Royal Academy, by Colin McCrudden, is it? Who's at Queen's. A very good analysis of the Good Friday Agreement, but with the economic implications and economic citizenship. Now, it's huge transaction costs, which is the cost of doing business. There's 494 treaty changes, 12,000 product regulations to be renegotiated, and 6,256 World Treaty Organization tariff lines to be negotiated with. This is just for fisheries and agriculture. Now, for Northern Ireland as well as the Republic, it's most complex and challenging, and not well understood by UK government, policymakers, or the media. There's such a disinterest in Northern Ireland, and I think this is a remarkable place, and I say often, it's punched above its weight politically, below its weight economically. But this is a remarkable place. Okay, so these are the issues. An edited book that David Bailey asked and I did, it came out in April, and it has various issues. But the issues I have been investigating and want to continue to look at, and it's a paper that Graham and I are trying to finish off, is the Brexit trade deals is what is called club goods. I'll explain that. The key impacts, an all-island single market, which exists and has a number of constitutional and political issues over and above the economic issues. The border paradox for agribusiness, challenges and the special status of governments. Okay, the idea that the comes from a club goods, it's from the work of James Buchanan. And the analogy is a sports club. And if you go to my local gym on a Monday night, it gets very packed, so you have to hang around to watch the machines, which defeats the purpose. So although it's a collective membership that you pay a fee for, you get the collective benefits, but you get up to a point at which you get congestion. And my argument is, well, actually, a lot of the trade deals on offer, which are apparently going to happen very quickly, we are told, you hit economic congestion fairly quickly compared to EU membership. And we're working on evidence to show that. Now, so there's the... And when you get to that congestion point, you will get greater transaction costs. I mean, I do find it extraordinary. I was in 30 years as an academic, spending a lot of time in meetings. And I thought, if Martians came down here and looked at human beings and how much they spend time in meetings, they would just get in their spaceships and go off not come back. And similarly, I've been watching the evidence on the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee about the border problem. And the evidence given by the witness is very good. But what's the extraordinary amount of time that, should we say, some of our elected representatives have spent completely misunderstanding or not even wanting to understand these issues. And it's this kind of endless transaction costs, the cost of administering government, but also the cost for business. Excuse me. Now, like most academics, I'm very good at stealing other people's ideas. And this came from a report by the research service here, which is a really good report on all the trade deals. And what I did was just adapt it as the different club goods on offer and that table. And these obviously are available. And if you would like a fuller version of this, and there's actually a version of this in the chapter in the book on the political economy of Brexit, which I did, which is about the impact on Northern Ireland. So there's some, you can actually see what the financial contribution, the influence of rules are, and what kind of benefit there may be there to agriculture and fisheries. But the fundamental issue, and again, I've done so many Brexit events. Last year on my birthday, I was persuaded against my better judgment by a law firm to be on a Brexit panel with a mystery guest who turned out to be Anne Widdecombe. I accused her of being French because she claimed she was Cornish. And it was interesting. What was interesting was that the way in which the local Leave campaign packed out of these events. I can look after myself. I look like an aging skinhead with a desperate down chin. But a lot of these people reminded me of ex-Combat 18. I mean, their sense of Englishness, which never existed, and their venom about the EU, even though they bent it, was actually quite extraordinary. But that's, you know, that's as it is. But the other issue, and I did give evidence in the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee on the economic impact of Brexit, and I'm happy to say this, but out of the 23 members of that committee, only three, and one was Lady Hernan, actually had any understanding of the issues. It was quite extraordinary. And we get the elected representatives we deserve. And again, the one thing I've always said here in working with the Enterprise Trade and Investment Committee was the MLAs here, for all their faults, are at least embedded in their communities, and they appear to want to look after their interests. And when people talk about the Westminster bubble, it is a bubble, both of media commentators and politicians, and very few who actually understand what's going on in the whole of Ireland, let alone the rest of the EU. So the EU referendum and the US elections demonstrated ignorance by politicians and commentators about modern economies and trade. And it's been unchallenged by communication to the public, particularly the BBC, who don't really, again, want to come to Belfast to actually explore the issues. Economic globalisation was first driven by trade, followed by foreign direct investment. And foreign direct investment enables global production networks, and that's what's called global value change. That's modern economies. It's the third unbundling of globalisation, as Richard Baldwin, the international trade theorist, said. And global supply chains provide the link between global production networks and global value chains. They're the drivers of global trade. 60% of EU trade is within firms. The whole of the EU is a regionalised global production network. And we see that in agribusiness with certain brands of Irish cheese going, the ingredients going either side of the border, packaged in Liverpool, and then come back again. That's a very simple example. There's others. And this is just an example of a regionalised production network, which is BMW's, which has expanded. They're one based in the EU, which is mainly know-how, high-tech, and increasingly it'll be electric vehicles. and then serving a regional network, which is mainly, again, about the supply chains. But as you get the third unbundling of globalization, according to Baldwin, you'll start and get that know-how locally. So you now see China is in the lead of high-speed trains and other kinds of activity, where formerly it was seen as part of a regionalized production network. It was mainly about manufacturing. And the other one is, I was going to put Boeing up. My father worked for British Airways for 30 years, so basically I'm a plane spotter. But this just shows the A380 of the different countries and where it comes from. So Airbus has this European global production network. It's also linked to one in China because they build under license the A320s for that market. So it's not about nations anymore. And so when people talk about percentage of trade, I mean, it's a first marker, but you've actually got to look at what's going in within firms that are part of these regionalized global production networks. And what these regionalized production networks do is make regional trade agreements and areas like the EU, like NAFTA, like Mercosur, like ASEAN, the basis of economic development, not just bilateral trade. Now, the Northern Ireland economy has a lot of challenges. And one of them is an over-reliance on FDI. There's a myth that the Republic became the tiger economy just the basis on tax cuts. And that stimulated FDI. It's one of the great canards that politicians love to talk about. The Irish economy really expanded when it became a member of the single market. It's market access and the size of the market. And the tax take of corporation tax in Northern Ireland, and that's going to be cut to 12.5%, is 1.2% of an already narrow tax base. It's trivial. And actually, it's going to lead to a net loss. And this is a quote from Angela McGowan, the director of CBI. But the challenges in Northern Ireland, the ones like in the rest of the UK, it's an issue about productivity, issue about skills, economic inactivity rates, investment and innovation and process innovation, which is about management. And again, despite the promise of a number of the industries, this is labour productivity. And in ICT, construction and support services, two of which are part of the six matrix sectors, which are the leading sectors as the basis of the economic strategy, are actually the worst performers. But there's a long history. I mean, Graham Brownlow at Queen's, he gave a paper a couple of weeks ago at a seminar on industrial strategy. If you look at the economic history of Northern Ireland, it's always been bedeviled by family-owned firms that are small firms. And family-owned firms tend to be less productive, and small firms tend to be less productive. And that's across the whole of the UK. And that's just... And they're vulnerable to Brexit, and they're the sectors, because there's a narrow export base in Northern Ireland economy, and that impacts upon productivity, and thus its attractiveness to foreign direct investment. 58% of NI exports are to the EU, 35% to the Republic, and the UK accounts for 17%. The loss of funding is about EU funding would be $500 million a year, plus what's an estimated net loss of Barnett funding as a result of devolution of corporation tax. That's $1 billion loss in a $27 billion economy. So that's, you know, it actually makes the EU's the UK's contribution to the EU budget at 0.6% of GDP look trivial. And it's exacerbated, and this is my estimate for the committee of a couple of years ago, of 3% by GDP, lower intra-firm trade across the border, cross-border cooperation, which is just not the border, it's the whole of Ireland. And there's a lot of going on under the radar here that would be damaged by Brexit. And less FDI, so uncertainty and higher transaction costs. So this is all, so you do have an all-island single market in a number of key sectors, particularly agri-food or agri-business. So you can actually see services tend to lag behind industrial sectors, although there's always a false division between services and manufacture. I've always asked students whether software is a manufacture or a service, and some say it's a service, some say it's a manufacturer. It's both. And if you actually look at advanced manufacturing, a lot of that is services. For example, Rolls-Royce don't make any money selling jet engines. They make money providing business and finance services. And you could increasingly argue with the advent of hybrid vehicles that car manufacturers are starting to become financial services firms. You've got it in mining now. I mean, it's VW wants to buy, has made a big, put out a big contract call for Cobalt to, because it's going to become an all-electric vehicle company by 2020. And Cobalt is, and lithium are the major components of batteries. Anyway, that's by the by. So if you look at all-island trade, you actually see Northern Ireland has, on those simple terms, as said earlier, has a balance of payment surplus. But cross-border trade is clearly very important to both sides. Now, the trade effects, and again, I'm not looking in intra-firm trade and global value chains here, because it's actually very difficult to get the data. But these are the figures, and the export loss to the UK is nearly 10% for manufacturers, 7.5% for services. The EU is much less. It's 1.36% and 2.1%. Now, agri-food is very important in the whole of Ireland. It's also some of the most advanced agri-food businesses in the world for, as far as sustainability is concerned. And you've also got the biggest foreign, the biggest firm in Northern Ireland is Moy Park, which was Brazilian, now is American. So it's a, you know, employs 6,500 people. That's a lot of people. And so it's just not the narrow figures about employment. So that's 6% employment. It's also about the linkages to business here and banks and about how you actually fund them. So the border question is crucial because Irish cows don't respect borders. And that was a quote from, I think it's the chair of the Ireland Rural Affairs. You know, because you've, I mean, apart from sort of hard border on those institutions, you've actually got cross-border cooperation on fisheries, on, and I said, a global value chain in Irish agri-food. And Irish, all kinds of Irish agri-food are exported all over the world and actually is a well-known brand. And those things are quite important because brands actually in this become an important non-tariff barrier. Right, I'll get to the end very quickly. So this idea of economic citizenship comes from the economic theory of government, of which there's the economic theory of government, it has three functions: allocation of resources, distribution, and stabilization of resources, and that's macroeconomic policy. And socioeconomic welfare and well-being in the territories that people inhabit. Now, the austerity governance of the EU in the last 10 years has now actually been shown to be the economic nonsense it always was. And even the OECD, the IMF, saying equality contributes to growth. Beyond that, if you go to the Oates theorem, decentralized and federal systems of government have greater growth, greater equality. So the two are tied. And there's a constitutional underwriting of that. The original German social market economy is based on an economic order. As much market as possible, as much government as necessary. But there's an idea of an economic order. Now, I'm not saying there should be, but actually if you have a constitutionally underwritten economic guarantees, in a sense, and rights about equality, about distribution, about the allocation of resources, that ties a number of things together of economic citizenship and governance. And Northern Ireland is a special case, and the whole of Ireland is a special case. And anyone who denies that, well, I won't say. Anyway. So The agri-food sector is crucial in assessing the investigation of the consequences of Brexit. It makes a very good case study and those kind of linkages. And its significant position in regard to cross-border trade, economic cooperation, environmental sustainability, and balancing between the rural and the urban economy. And the rural economy and its culture is crucial to both sides of Ireland. But there is a danger of a shift south. And I'll quickly show the regional imbalances. Because one thing that there was evidence given by a young sociologist at Queen's at the Northern Ireland Affairs Committee, pointing out because of the Good Friday Agreement, there's been a lot more economic development along the border on the north side, which tends to be wealthier ahead than just the south. But it's actually contributed to regional, greater regional balance in the whole of Ireland because of security, because of the opportunities that opens up. And again, you can see that the two cities dominate. But although Michael O'Leary's joke about Brexit, Brexit does provide an opportunity and threat for Dublin because fintech is likely to go there. A lot of business and services associated with financial services, big data. And now that Airbus has come to the rescue, will Bombardier still be in Northern Ireland? So there's big questions there. So finally, by way of conclusion, so they're more complex, magnified versions. What kind of club good is going to be chosen from Northern Ireland? And as I said, although it's constitutionally written about rights, it still stands as the underwriter of economic citizenship and governance for the whole of Ireland. And again, that's a quote for from the last sentence in the chapter of my book. And Break Bad refers to the Netflix series Breaking Bad and about Heisenberg and the Heisenberg principle. But the logic does extend to the rest of Ireland in that without an all-island governance solution, damage to economic citizenship may be irrevocable. The political consequences may be unpalatable, but ultimately necessary. I'm not a political scientist and I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I think there's an implication there. So a lot of the debates about customs unions and the single market and whether that should be the North Sea or should start at the Isle of Man misses the point. It's the constitutional framing of the Good Friday Agreement and what happens, and the socioeconomic and political consequences arise from that. And I think that at the moment, it's understood by Michel Barnier, and he understands very well agriculture. He was an agriculture minister, he's a finance minister, and he was a regional commissioner for the commission. And he seems to personify the kind of differences, and as I say, the capacities and capabilities of negotiators. And this is just a metaphor, again, on Plane Spotter. This is the Bombardier C series. And if you look at all those international companies, and the weakness of the UK's position with regard to Northern Ireland came about with the Boeing case and the Department of Justice case against the so-called subsidies of Bombardier. Airbus has come to the rescue. The question is, post-Brexit, will Airbus still be in the UK or will they be in Ireland? I'll leave you with that thought. Thanks very much.